Well, hello, everybody. You are listening to Open Air, and you're expecting to hear David LaTulipe, but he's not here this week, and I'm Leah Garchick, and I'm going to try and fill his gigantic shoes. So forgive me if it's a little bit, if the road is a little bit rocky, but I will do my best. We have an exciting show that's coming up. First, we're going to talk to Adrian Roberts and Leontine Mbele Mbong, who are Lady Macbeth in the reverse order, are Macbeth and Lady Macbeth in the African-American Shakespeare Company's version of the play, which has been updated, and we'll talk about that. And second, we're talking to Jose Maria Condemni, who is an opera guy, and he is directing the Schwabacher Summer Concert that's part of the Merola Opera Program. And the first concert of that is tonight, actually, you should know. So he'll be second up. Third up will be the Sally Bowles and Herr Schultz from the San Francisco Playhouse production of Cabaret. I'm sure Cabaret is familiar to so many. This is a wonderful version of it that I have seen, which sort of gives me an advantage in talking that. I haven't seen the Shakespeare, but you're in for a good time. That's such sweet music, but don't let it lull you. This new version of Macbeth, which is a pretty fast and furious play, one of Shakespeare's, well, probably Shakespeare's most well-known play, don't you think?
Yeah,
In terms of tragedies, I guess, yes. Romeo and Juliet is probably the one that's farthest up there, yeah.
Oh, but yeah, at least on greeting cards. It seems like there aren't many Macbeth greeting cards.
No, strangely.
So this is a new version that was written for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival by Migdalia Cruz. Mm-hmm. And first, Leontine, do you mind if I call you by your first names?
No, it's fine.
By all means.
Okay, because how is it new? How does it differ?
So this play-on project, which was started by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, basically commissioned playwrights, various playwrights, and the idea was to get playwrights of color and women to sort of translate, as it were, Shakespeare, sort of remove the obsolete, obscure references that no one gets nowadays, references to things like limbic, which I said last night in the run, which is no longer in the script, words like that, to kind of remove them so that the audience can just get to the story quicker and glom on to these storylines and the themes of the play without having to struggle with what is that word and what does that mean. So in this particular version, she's basically left it pretty much alone and just sort of restructured sentences so that the phrasing is less scrambled and as Shakespeare tends to get, and changed vocabulary words. But it's not a drastic difference. So chances are, if you don't know Shakespeare super, super well, if you're not following along with the script, you may not be able to necessarily tell the difference.
So if you're sitting there waiting for out, out, damn spot, you're
going
to hear
You are going to hear out, out, damn spot. You are going to hear to be king is nothing but to be safely so. Those iconic phrases, yes, she has left as they are.
Adrian, had you ever played this role before?
No, but I've seen it done.
You've seen it. So was it, I mean, the words must be, you're actors, so you absorb those words. Was it difficult to absorb the new words?
No. You have this adaptation, and then you can go back and get, like, your Pelican Shakespeare, and you can compare, you know, what's changed and what's the same. saying these words, this is a one, these are two, I'm having a lot of fun. These are two really fun roles to play, I think. And it's just, you take this roller coaster ride, you know, and like Shakespeare, the heightened emotions take you to these places. And it's just, I don't know, it's just fun to like say these words, live this life, and experience these things. And then you come out of it feeling like, when we do these run-throughs, I always come out at the end of it, I'm tired, but a good tired, and I just feel exhilarated.
So it's fun playing these characters, all wound up this, to
well,
dead.
I liken it to like, you know, I used to watch a lot of old movies with my grandmother, and I like, you know, when you get into this play, it's like a thriller. It's one of those old black and white, you know what I mean? Like, you sit on this couch and you can sit on a Sunday and really enjoy it. It has witches, it's the supernatural elements of it. Mm-hmm. And then
I hope the witches aren't all young or aren't all old. I mean,
No. This is a nice, I think, a very fresh take on this play.
Yeah,
Leontine, tell me about the witches. How are the witches? The Witch Defense Society.
I see. So yes. So no, they are not. They are not aged and
no warts.
No warts. None of that. No, they are actually quite fresh faced. Our witches are very fresh faced young women who I think that the thing with this is, I mean, this play is a play within a play, right? The way that we structured it is that the concept is that it's a play that's going on in Tyrone, as we like to call him, Macbeth's head. So
is that a theater thing about the luck of not saying the word?
No, it's just that because we've created the, so there's a homeless community, and they are coming back from protests, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with the state of homelessness and how to sort of assert their rights. And we have this character Tyrone, who is kind of like at loggerheads with them over how this should be done. And so Macbeth kind of comes out of his head as, what would it be like if I asserted my power and
in this homeless encampment?
Because
it's more of a dystopian society. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not, when, you know, we live in the Bay Area, so we know what that problem is about, right? And when you get off certain, you know, off ramps, and you just see it. So it could be set in this time, but it's also kind of a dystopian future where the encampments, it's gotten to the point where there are warring factions now. You know, we're warring against the police, we're warring against other homeless encampments. It's gotten to the point where it's really bad. And so this is, Peter Callender, the director, asked us to think of not only our characters as in the play Macbeth, but what are your characters as homeless people? So hence the nickname Tyrone, who I play as an ex-military vet who from Afghanistan, Iraq wars, who has fallen on hard times, who's become homeless, Purple Heart winner, you know, which is based on a lot of true stories that you hear out there. And so
is this, Adrian, is this typical for actors? It sounds like a pretty intense experience, as it is just walking down the street in San Francisco, anywhere. And while you're working on this and thinking about the issues of the play, does that alter your thinking about what you're seeing in front of you?
Well, for me, I, you know, personally, you know, we talk about this all the time, because when she drops me off at the train station at night after rehearsal, and we drive by certain things, and I go, well, it hits home even more, I think, you know, because you tend to think like, well, that's not me, but I think what you have to say is, but there for the grace of God go I, right? Because we're all connected, and in a city of so much wealth, it is hard to imagine that the people who have the means to help the situation, not just us common folk, because we can all do our part, but the people who really have the means to do it don't do anything. And so I think this message, this where we're setting the play, is very important, because it's right outside our front door. And if we can't take care of our fellow man, if we can't understand the plight, not everybody, some people just fall on hard times and it's hard to bounce back.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're on the street and you hear a lot of people go, I didn't think I'd be here. You know, they talk about people over 50
who have a hard time, you know, getting jobs if they've been let go, and a lot of them end up on the street. So
I think the play for both of us, mm-hmm. and so it's fun to put it in this world,
yeah.
to bring out those issues, and but still keep the themes of the play.
Have people, Lantine, excuse me, have you've already done run-throughs in front of audiences?
No, we have our first audience.
There were no
tomorrow.
Previews.
Mm-hmm. We have our first audience tomorrow, which is a preview that we, the African American Shakespeare Company, has it set up to invite teachers to attend for free. And that'll be our first audience. We'll see what
great.
They make of it.
Yeah.
So was the playwright, has this been performed before, ever?
No, this is
so
the premiere of this version.
So was the playwright looking at your rehearsals and making alterations?
No. Peter and I worked on the script and cutting it, as one does with Shakespeare.
Yeah, even though this started as the shortest Shakespearean play, right?
And yet still, snip, snip, snip. And then we met with Migdalia Cruz and went over the cuts and see, because obviously, you know, as a playwright, which she is, even though this it's based on a play that was written ages ago, she still has an investment in, you know, in her work and in her and in her translation and her kind of conceptualization. So we met with her to discuss sort of the cuts and to see, okay, what do you absolutely want to hold on to? What can we let go of, et cetera, et cetera? And
was
then,
that difficult?
We were trepidatious about it because, you know, it always feels like, oh, my God, we're cutting your work and you spent so much time on this. And we know how much research and work and sweat and that you put into this. So I'm so sorry, but we do need to cut, you know, because we have our concept, too, and all of that. So but it turned out to be actually very amicable, and she was very amenable to our changes, and so we had kind of worked ourselves up into a but it worked out very nicely, and she was very very open to the changes. And then she had to go off because PlayOn was having a reading of all 39 plays that they have in New York.
They did that a couple of weeks ago.
She couldn't be here, but I think we are expecting her back for opening.
It sounds as though, from the role of the witches and all that, that there's a feminist slant on this. So is Lady Macbeth in this version cast less as the plotter pushing her husband to wrongdoing than she is in the classic version?
Well, that is an interesting question. because for all that, yes. I mean, the intent is that... you don't want Lady Macbeth to be the evil, conniving, you know, this is all her fault kind of thing. So we had a lot of conversations about where that balance lay.
Both complicit.
Yeah, they are both complicit. There is the fact of the language that, you know, she spends a lot of time chiding and berating him for
I'll say this.
Get on with it.
She is more suited for the throne than he is. I'll put it that way. So in order to say that, I don't think from doing the play now and rehearsing it, she's not chiding him. She's not pushing him. These thoughts are already in him, right?
Yeah.
So they're almost two sides of the same coin. She just has...
So it's a good marriage.
Yeah, well, it's they're both... She has the scruples and the ruthlessness in order... I mean, if we want to put it in traditional Scottish clan times, I mean... Those kings, I mean, they kill left and right. So it's not easy being king. It's not easy to keep the throne, and you have to have a certain amount of ruthlessness and scruples to do it. And she has that. So it's not this thing of like everybody goes, oh, she pushes him to it. It's like no, he has a lot of complicity in it because those thoughts of regicide are in his mind too. It
mm-hmm.
just. You know, and that's where the witches come in, because they're just, that's the fate. That's them just playing a game with mortal man saying, well, let's see, let's plant this in his thing and see what happens.
I think, too, that for her, and kind of the way that I justified it, was the notion that you live in a world where women sometimes can't get as far as they want to go, or, you know, they get stopped by these men who say that they're not good enough or capable enough or whatever. And yet you encounter situations like this where you're like, all right, well, this is what you want, then do the thing that it is that you want. Like, don't be all, well, I would like this. I mean, she has this whole speech about what you would like to have, you want to just have happen without ever actually doing it.
So
either stick to what it is that your principles are and do what it takes to achieve them,
or let it go, let the idea go. And mm-hmm. I think that she just has this thought of, okay, well, if this is what we want, then we need to adhere to that, own that, mm-hmm. and go through with what it takes to get there. And you can't have these both worlds of, well, I want
waffling.
It. Yeah.
Is this, why do you think this play has such a special place? You said, you're right, that Romeo and Juliet is really the most well-known, but this is, everybody reads Macbeth in high school. Mm. Why this play?
He wrote this at the same time, I think, when he wrote Hamlet. So the characters are certain similarities in inaction and action, right, to do the deed. And I think the themes of it, you know, ambition, what are you willing to do to get it? Are you suited for the throne when you get it? And leading is not easy. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks, oh, I can do this, but when you actually have the thing, there's so many things that come with it, you know? And I just, and I think also, it's a, like I said, it's a fun play because he puts in the supernatural and it just heightens a lot of things, especially at that time period when he wrote the play. Mm-hmm. Supernatural and belief in witches and all that kind mm-hmm. was really big and huge. Mm-hmm. And he put all that in there, and I think it just makes it fun and rich.
You know? And I'm curious, because I haven't seen it, is the language, do you speak in a conversational tone, or is it more Shakespearean, more classical Shakespearean?
We don't declaim.
Right. Yeah, that's the word. Thank you.
But yeah, there's a little bit of both. I mean, part of the beauty of the language is that it is poetry. And so there are scenes that, yeah, you know, I think that one of our scenes, it is very conversational, and then there are others that are monologues that are just flights of thought and fancy and imagination where you can't help but, where it's not a conversation, it is a heightened mode of communication. And so there is both of those
the
elements.
Imagery is very important.
Yes.
I mean, the way he
yes.
writes, it's why he's probably the best, because he's able to, within a few words, capture a moment, an emotion. And if you're doing, and it's like, you know, great playwrights, half the work is done for you. You know, you really, you get on that horse and you just ride it. And when they take you that piece, but they also, like I like to say, all great playwrights exact their pound of flesh. Mm. Because they are...
Because that's a Shakespearean phrase.
Well, but they demand things of you as the actor.
Uh-huh.
All your faculties, from speech, diction, mm. emotion, truthfulness, saying the poetry so it's understood by the audience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's from Chekhov to Shakespeare to all the great ones.
So as actors, we're nearing the end, so mm-hmm. this is a good last question. Mm-hmm. As... To both of you, as actors, does it feel like a especially profound endeavor to take on doing this?
It's a privilege.
Yes.
And an honor. How many guys, you know, has done this role? How many famous actresses, actors? And you can go on YouTube and watch them, and you just, you know, the best of the best, you know, from Ian McKellen, Judi Dench, Patrick Stewart.
Have you done that? Have you...
I've peaked.
Watched. Not recently. Not recently. I try not to just before a show that I'm doing to watch somebody.
No, I did it like prior, a couple months prior.
Yeah, but I've seen
okay,
the Ian McKellen
so
Judi
if you
Dench
peaked.
One.
Yeah. I mean, you've just said that on the radio. Which mm-hmm. one was the one that moved you most?
I love the Ian McKellen Judi Dench mm-hmm. RSC version, black box version. Mm-hmm.
It's very, I don't know. It's just those guys, you know, those are the masters. So mm-hmm. you, I watch just to, because they own it. They claim it. So they just do the language a certain way that, you know, but I think Americans have a facility for it too. I think where they might be more cerebral in some things. I think we have an emotion that we bring to the table that makes it
Well, the progression in this play from ambition to guilt to madness, that sounds kind of American, actually.
Yes, and I think that that's one of the things that makes this play particularly special to do at this time in terms of what it says about leadership and what a leader owes his people, how he achieves his ambition, and who he slays in getting there. And
you can be a thug, or you can do it with grace.
Okay. Yep. Well, I thank you so much, and everybody will have a chance to see this starting on July 13th to July 28th at the Taub Atrium Theater. That's in the Veterans War Memorial Building. It is, again, the African-American Shakespeare Company's version of Macbeth, and thank you so much for being here. It was really fun talking with you.
Thank you.
Fun talking
thank
to you.
You for having us.
Okay. Once again, you're on Open Air. This is not David LaTulippe, the regular host, but Leah Garchek. I'm filling in. And our second guest today is Jose Maria Condemi, and he's an opera guy. He's an opera director, and he's going to first describe what that music was about, and then we'll talk about why he's here.
So that is from one of Puccini's operas called La Rondine, which is one of his least performed ones. And the scene, we are in Paris in the 19th century, and we're at the house of Magda, who's a courtesan. She's engaged to this rich guy called Rambaldo. But there's a poet. She has a friend who's a poet called Prunier, and he's very much for romantic love. So he wrote a song, which he sang, in which he tells a story of a girl called Doretta who fell in love for a king, but ended up turning him down because she didn't want to be bound by riches and money. She wanted true love.
Oh, this is not the story of Macbeth that we
no,
were just talking about.
No, very different.
Quite a different thing. So, Maestro Candemi, shall I call you
We
that?
Usually reserve Maestro for the conductors, but okay. Some people call me Maestro.
Okay, but maybe can I call you Jose?
Yes, is please. That okay? Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
He is with the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and he directs the opera directing.
I am the chair of the Opera Musical Theater Department. Yeah,
oh, well,
for the conservatory, yeah.
Right, and he is the director of the Schwabacher Summer Concert. There will be a performance tonight at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and then on Saturday in the afternoon at 2 p.m. at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. So this annual concert is part of the Merula program,
which is part of the San Francisco Opera. So we're just guests at the conservatory, right. And it has, you know, it's a separate. It's not presented by the conservatory. It's presented by the San Francisco Opera Center and the Merula program, which is a training branch,
right,
of the San Francisco Opera,
and which you are an alum of.
I am.
So can you, let's do this chronologically. Can you describe how you first came here from Merula? I think you were in it 2 years. Yes.
Yeah, so the Merula program is one of the preeminent training programs for opera singers, as well as opera coaches and directors like myself, as one of the best in the world. And so it's very well known. And I was finishing my graduate studies at the University of Cincinnati. So I applied, and I got admitted in 1999 and 2000. And it's a great opportunity, particularly for directors like myself, because there's not that many ways to break into a career, you know. So it provided excellent training and also an opportunity to kickstart my career. And I've been involved with them since then, directing and teaching up to now.
So you always knew your career would be as a director?
No. it's a second career, actually. I started medical school first, and then I left that halfway and became an opera director.
But your opera career, you always knew that it would be,
yes,
as a director.
I never sang. Yeah, I did play the piano, but directing was my first career in opera.
And obviously you love music. Do you like telling people what to do, too?
A little bit. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I love telling stories. So that's what's the job of a director, is to tell a story through movement. And
And in this particular concert, it's scenes from how many operas?
Five.
Five.
And some of them are pretty long, like the Rondine scene that we just listened to. We're actually doing all of Act One of the opera, so the entire first act.
And how did you choose which ones there would be?
No, they were selected by the director of the Merula program based on the voices that we knew we were having.
So are they completely separate? They're not linked to each other in any way?
No, they're not.
And I assume that they display a variety of techniques and voices.
Yeah,
and
styles, languages, periods, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so how many singers altogether are involved in this concert?
11.
Wow. And are there costumes? Is there...
Yeah,
scenery?
there's a it's fully staged. You know, we don't have a set, but we use props and furniture pieces, and they were it's concert gowns, but there's things that we do to them to make them more to better represent the characters they're performing.
So this must be an interesting challenge to you. I mean, you've probably directed full-blown opera performances too, but here you have many more limited array of tools to present.
Yeah, but the basic tools are, you know, with the performer, right? I mean, you can put a great costume and a set on a performer, and the story can be not well told. So to me, you know, the power of a performer is the storytelling skills that he or she may have, and how we tell a story through language and the use of the body. So I don't feel that this format is, you know, I don't feel handicapped by not having, you know, large production.
Are the singers who participate, the Merulini?
Yes.
Do they come to the Merulini program with all kinds of levels of...
They do.
I mean, they all have wonderful skills, I'm sure, but all kinds of levels of training? And
they do, and many of them come from different countries. I mean, we have a singer from Korea, New Zealand, Colombia. So not only they have different levels, they come to us with different levels of training and skills, but also different types of training.
And what's their age range?
Oh, they are very young, in their 20s.
So yeah. They listen to you.
They do, and they're extremely talented. And, you know, the Merla program has nurtured some of the best talent in opera in the world for many years. So it's always exciting to get to work with many of them in their sort of budding stages and know that many of them will become quite well known.
When the process for interviewing or auditioning,
yes.
I suppose people send tapes.
They do, yeah.
And that happens to the opera, I mean, to the Merrill of people.
Yeah, so there's about 800 singers apply. Not everybody gets invited to auditions, so there's a first pre-screening that happens through letters of recommendation, videos, and tapes. And then those who get invited to audition, then, you know, just 20 of them get selected.
Were any of your students at the conservatory?
There's two students of mine from the conservatory that are not involved in this project, but they are in the world premiere of Jake Hayes' opera, If I Were You, which happens later in the month,
in August. This is all part of the Merla presentations.
Yes, yes.
So can you talk about what other things there are?
So we're this Schaubacher concert tonight and on Saturday is sort of the main, the first main event. And then it's followed by a world premiere of Jake Hayes' new opera, If I Were You, which I think is the first weekend of August. And then there's the culminating concert. It's called the Merla Grand Finale, and that is on the stage of the War Memorial Opera House. And it's at the very end. I don't have the dates, I'm sorry. At the very end of the program. And that's another fully staged night of opera scenes and arias.
Anybody who's interested in the dates, by the way, can look at merla.org and find out everything that they want to do. Okay. So, let's see. I was looking at the website and I lost my... Is it... the scenes that are chosen, and a performer just popping into that must be a special skill. I mean, they're telling a part of a story. You are telling the audience a part of a story. And while it's a special skill for the audience to imagine what's gone before it and what's going to go after it, it must be a special skill for the singer to fully inhabit a role.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, we deal with stories that happen in a particular period, or there's cultural things that make the story make sense. For example, we're doing a scene from Lucia di Lammermoor, Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, in which the culture of that, the characters, you know, were in Scotland many centuries ago. So ghost stories and a supernatural understanding of the world is very important to the storytelling. Basically, Lucia, the main character, she believes in ghosts and she's seen a ghost. So sometimes talking about that and doing some research about what's surrounding the story of the opera and the scene is very, very important. In the case of La Rondine, the one we just talked about, you know, the concept of a courtesan, which is not a prostitute. It's, you know, it's a high-class companion.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't have that anymore. So we have, you know, we have to discuss, you know, what it meant to be in Paris in the 19th century and to be Magda, the main character. What does it mean to be a courtesan or to have a protector like Rambaldo?
So for many of these young singers... These issues, the acting issues, actually, is this a very early experience at that for them? I mean, they have obviously been coached for years on their singing styles, but your role must be, you have to set the stage and tell them how to perform, but a lot of that performance... depends on their acting.
Yep.
So is that new to them?
I mean, some of them have a lot of experience. You know, some of them go to schools in which they do full productions and, you know, they are quite experienced. But it's always, you know, we're also performing in foreign language. We don't do anything in English in this concert. So there's always that barrier where even though they know very well what they're saying, the fact that they're singing in Italian, German, or French, it takes a little bit of time to make that language their own, even though they will know, they know the translation from the beginning. So becoming one with the language, with the foreign language, is very important to their ability to perform their roles convincingly.
So is that in the opera department, that at the conservatory, do you have people that particularly coach that?
Every training program has, and particularly in Merla, diction and language coaches. So I, at Merla, for example, they take, so there's, when we are working in our scenes, the diction coach, the French coach or the German coach will come and work with them on diction for the scenes. But aside from that, they also have language classes that are separate, because you know it's also important for them to learn how to speak Italian, not just pronounce it. Because you know many of them may go to Europe and work in Germany, or Italy, or you know. And it's also there. These are the universal languages of opera, so it's important for them to know.
Are there super titles at this?
Yes,
at,
we do
at this performance.
Yeah, we have super titles. Yeah.
Okay, so the audience members can relax and just listen to the music and. Can you talk about the performances are going to include what you just heard a sample of, La Rondine, yes?
Yes.
And Lucia di Lammermoor, and the other one, which I want you to say rather than me having to pronounce it.
Die Schweigsame Frau.
Yeah, I'm so glad I made that
The Silent
choice.
Woman. So, it translates to The Silent Woman. It's one of the most rarely performed opera by Richard Strauss. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting piece. It's just not one of the meat and potatoes ones of his repertoire.
Well, a silent woman doesn't sound like a great subject for an opera.
Oh, it's actually a comedy. It's a light comedy. It's about a guy who hates sound. So somebody's trying to fool him into marrying somebody. So it's a light comedy. It's a fun one.
And then there'll also be a scene from Faust.
Yeah, Gounod's Faust.
And Il Trovatore.
Il Trovatore.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so, and you have directed this concert before?
No. Oh, you mean for the program?
Yes.
Yes, I have done it before, yes.
And what was the biggest surprise you ever had listening to the singers?
Well, you know,
the biggest delight.
Yeah, they're extremely talented young singers, and sometimes they surprise you. A few days ago, one of our singers just made a huge leap from one day to the next, and it was revelatory. And that was always thrilling to watch because, you know, we know they have the talent. We know that we're working very hard, but, you know, there's a part that can only...
In terms of, can you describe that leap in terms of voice or...
It was the voice. It was also just the way she owned the stage, you know, how she just carried herself and made her...
So those are the things that you as director can take some particular
Well, of course, yeah, but she did it and she surprised us all. So we were thrilled for her.
Okay, so I say bravo to her.
Yes, I did many times.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
This has been wonderful. Everybody, you should know that the first concert, there are only two performances of the Schwabacher Summer Concert, which is part of the Merla Opera Program. And the first one is tonight at 7:30, and then Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. at the San Francisco Conservatory. We've been talking to Jose Maria Candemi, who is the director.
Thank you so much.
I give you that international sensation, Fräulein Sally Bowles! What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. It's time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine, come hear the band, come blow your horn, start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. What good's permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away? Life is a cabaret, old chum, so come to the cabaret. I used to have this girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. As a matter of fact, she rented by the hour. The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen. I think of Elsie to this very day. I remember how she turned to me and said, what good is sitting all alone in your room? Come, hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me, and as for me, I made
hey,
my mind.
You are listening to Open Air. We're on KALW, and obviously I'm not David LaTulippe, but I'm subbing for David LaTulippe. And you've just heard Liza Minnelli singing Cabaret, the title song from the show and movie and the San Francisco Playhouse's latest production, which opened last week and will be here all summer at the San Francisco Playhouse on Post Street through September 14th. And our guests from that performance are Katie Heyman, who plays Sally Bowles, the lead, and Louis Parnell, who plays Herr Schultz, the sweet guy. The sweet guy who's going to be a victim.
Exactly.
We know.
Mm-hmm.
They're all victims in a way, though, of the time, aren't they?
Yes.
So this show has gotten absolutely terrific reviews. I saw it last week, which was a wonderful prelude to meeting you, actually. It was dazzling. And Katie, I hear you have been in this show, but not as Sally Bowles twice before.
So this will be my third production. And they were all this year. So, yeah.
So you played Frau Kost, Kost.
Yes, Fräulein,
right?
Fräulein Kost. Yeah.
Kost.
Both times.
And we should tell people what she is. She was not, as Jose said, a courtesan. She was a prostitute.
She's a prostitute. yeah, she's a prostitute who lives in Fräulein Schneider, who's Louis's main sea partner. She lives in the house, the boarding house that she owns.
Right. So, when you did those two prior roles in that, two prior productions of that, did you know that you were going to be playing Sally Bowles later in the summer?
No.
Or later in the year?
No. My first production was last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was far before I even knew that San Francisco Playhouse was doing this. And then my last production was, I did know that I was going to play Sally, but I was cast in that the year before. So when I was cast in it, I had no idea, but it was through school. Yeah. And I actually got this production because my voice teacher in Mill Valley, Suzanne Darley, is on the board of Marin Theater Company. And Dory, what's her last name? Dory.
The casting director?
Mm-hmm.
Dory Jacobs.
Dory Jacobs is the casting director at SF Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And was also on the Marin Theater Company board, and they knew each other, and she was like, hey, Suzanne, like, do you know anyone? We're looking for a cast. Do you know anyone who could play it? And she was like, you know, I actually have a student who has played her twice this year. She can send in a tape. And then I sent in a tape, and somehow I wound up as Sally. And I'm very, very thankful for it.
So were there things watching the previous Sallys that you learned that you incorporated into your portrayal of Sally?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, with the previous Sallys that I've been in shows with, and also, I mean, I love Liza. The movie is really different than the stage play, but I'm still a huge fan. So I've tried to, in the places that I can, sprinkle a little bit of Liza into my performance. She's been a big influence.
That's really interesting, because watching it, it's that role is so imprinted. She's so imprinted in that role, but this is a blonde Sally Bowles. That sounds very, as a very lighthearted description, but I thought that was meant to set you apart, to set you... Hey. I thought you made the character your own.
Why, thank you very much.
So,
she
Louis.
Did make the part her own. And we're all anticipating, looking forward to her Broadway debut within the next couple of years.
We'll see.
So, Louis, your love interest is a very sweet relationship, but anybody seeing Cabaret, which is set in 1929?
It's 1929, yes.
Right.
New Year's Eve, 1930.
Herr Schultz is a Jewish fruit vendor, and one knows that things are not going to go well for him. So could you incorporate that in your playing of the role?
Yes, well, when we sort of had a timeline and realized that certain things were happening, I mean, like, it's we sort of incorporated a five-year period into a five-month period, because obviously not everything that was transpiring in Germany, I mean, happened in a five-month period. But, you know, we encapsulated it down to that point. And one of the things, it's interesting that you have Kate and I on today on the show, because actually within the show, it's interesting because the two of us are the two characters who seem to be most like the ostriches, you know, with our head in the sands. We're in total denial about what's happening. Sally, because she doesn't care about politics. Herr Schultz, because he thinks of himself as a German first and not Jewish, and doesn't realize how far it's going to go.
Didn't you feel an impulse to kick your character and said, wake up?
Well, I constantly did. No, actually, our wonderful director, Susie DeBellano, I played the role before. And when we were rehearsing this one, you know, she was constantly having to remind me. It's like, no, I want him to be in denial. I want him to be in denial. And I'm going, you know, it's like, don't play the end before the beginning, which was a good lesson and certainly a good direction. Because, his naivete, I think even one of the reviews said that, you know, his naivete was breathtaking. Because, you know, he doesn't realize where it's going. And, of course, I don't want to give anything away, but this particular production of Cabaret has a dramatic end, which prior productions do not.
Yeah, I was...
I said, I don't know that I want to give it away in the air as to what happens, but, you know, it's rather devastating.
Yeah, it leaves you pretty much at the edge of your seat. But that's good for standing up and applauding, actually.
And of course, you know, I mean, having done the role 10 years ago, it was interesting because people say, what's the difference between then and now? Well, 10 years ago when we were doing it was at the point that Barack Obama had just been elected president. Today, the play has a lot more relevance than it did 10 years ago because of, you know, our political climate and what's going on.
And I was going to get to that sort of towards the end, but I wanted to, for a moment first, talk about the music is fantastic. Musical numbers are just amazing. And we're going to listen to a little bit of your singing that just, people were just, I saw jaws drop in the audience.
Love's a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady peaceful, lady happy, that's what I long to be.
What struck me about that, actually, and I hadn't listened to while, that was Liza. You have a higher pitched voice, so your singing that song just is particularly amazing.
Thank you.
She's a deeper alto than you are, isn't she?
I think. Kind. I mean, we just have different timbres, but
yeah,
different similar range, timbres. But different sounds. Yeah,
which is a word I wouldn't say because I wouldn't know whether it's pronounced timbres or timbres. Anyway, you are going to be a senior at Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
As to what you did on your summer vacation, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I would say so.
So, talk about that. Are you? I mean, there's a school of drama there, or a school of performing arts.
And, yeah, it's a school within the university. It's a school of drama, and it's a conservatory program. So I'm a musical theater major, but technically I'm getting a drama degree. So I take all the same classes as the acting majors do, with required additional singing and dancing classes. And then next semester, I'm actually going to Wales, the Royal Welsh Conservatory of Music and Drama, to study there from September to December, and then I finish my term and I graduate in Pittsburgh, which is crazy.
Is it hard for the star of the show, who is, I mean, your role is definitely the star of the show, as a younger person? I mean, do you take advice from Louis, is my question.
You know, yeah, I do. I share, this is also my first Equity role, so. And not only am I the youngest person in the cast, it's also really my first, like, real professional gig. And, you know, the Equity deputy is one of my dressing room partners. And so I ask them a lot of questions, and all of the cast have been really great supports to me in helping me kind of pave my way in this industry, just starting out. Because, you know, Louis here is he's been doing this forever.
So. How many times have you been Herr Schultz?
No, I've only played Herr Schultz. This is the second time playing Herr Schultz, but Cabaret is, it's part of my legacy because actually this will be the fourth time I've done the show, and Cabaret was my very first show in college. The very first show I auditioned for, I was cast in Cabaret, and I was one of the Kit Kat boys. The second time I did it in my mid-20s in a community theater production, and I was the MC. Then 10 years ago, at the Playhouse, it was my first time playing Herr Schultz, and then this is the second time. In fact, it was 10 years ago. It was just before I played it the last time. I was in New York on a trip, and I was in the West Village, and we walked by the Cherry Lane Theater, and that particular evening, they have personalities who do Q&As and, you know, talk about their career, and that particular night was Harold Prince. And so we said, oh, we have to go. So we went there, and afterwards, you know, we went up, and I got his autograph, and I said to him, I said, you know, in many ways, you've shaped my career because I've been doing cabaret my whole life. I said, I started out as a Kit Kat boy at 19, and now I'm about to play the old man. And in fact, it's interesting that you have Kate and I on because you have the youngest and the oldest member, you know, like in the cast.
So are you looking at her performance? Does that, in the way I asked her whether she takes advice from you, are you inspired by her performance?
Oh, I'm totally inspired by her because I've seen obviously a lot of Sally's. And as I think I said earlier, you know, we're all anticipating Kate to go on to bigger and better things. I mean, you know, I'm sure she's going to be headlining a Broadway show within the next 5 years.
What happens, Kate, when you're back at school? Do you go to auditions or what?
I don't. There are people at my school who do, but I don't have an agent, which I'm hoping to get. I'm hoping to get one at the end of my 4 years after Showcase. We have one in L.A. and one in New York. And
describe what Showcase is, where people perform and agents come. And
yeah, it's a show that the...
That must be nerve-wracking.
Yeah, a little bit. It's a show that the seniors put on for industry professionals, so like casting agents and talent agents and managers and, you know, just names in the industry can come and recruit talent. So we do a couple shows in New York and a couple shows in LA, trying to spread our net wide. So hopefully I'll get an agent and start kind of looking for work once I graduate.
How many people are in the musical comedy, the musical performance?
At my school?
Yeah.
In my class, I have 3 girls and 7 boys.
So it must be a pretty elite group.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a really competitive program to get into. I think when I auditioned, it was around like 2,000 people who auditioned, and then they took 12. And then since then we've like lost people to jobs, or people have dropped out or whatever. So now there's what, 7-10 of us out of 2,000 people who auditioned.
Obviously, if you've been listening, you know that Katie is a Bay Area native. She's from Mill Valley, and she was the winner of the Beach Blanket Babylon Scholarship Competition in 2016. But now, in answer to the subject you brought up, I've been thinking about this current events, and Trump was, I think, getting off the... Am I allowed to say that word on the air? Getting off...
<That word.
laughs> No, he was at Europe at the G8 or whatever it was. And... Or maybe at a campaign rally. And he actually said... It was 2 days after Jerry and I had seen your show. He said, "Tomorrow belongs to us."
Oh no. Gosh.
Really?
He was talking to Americans, so...
Wow.
Well, it's very scary. I mean, because I do realize that, you know, so many of us, I mean, we're in the Bay Area where a lot of people obviously do, you know, speak up. But it's funny how so many things are happening and we seem to have like no control over, or we look the other way. And it's, you know, we're looking at a fascistic state, unfortunately.
Well, before we get into that, it's been lovely having you here talking about a musical, not a musical comedy, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. So I was going to ask you if you liked fruit. Just say what your favorite fruit, because he plays a fruit vendor in Cabaret.
Well, of course I'm going to say that my favorite fruit is pineapple. No, I actually really do love pineapple, but the pineapple song it's a delight to do that every night. We love that song, and I do actually love pineapple.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Katie Heyman and Louis Parnell. Thank you so much. They're in Cabaret, which is playing all summer till September 14th at San Francisco Playhouse Production. It's at 450 Post Street.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, this has been a lot of fun, and it's about time to say goodbye, but I want to tell you about what's going to be on Open Air next week, where I'll still be hanging around and talking with playwright Carol Lashoff and Libby Vega about the world premiere production of Witch Hunt. Seems to be. We talked witches today, too. There's a lot of witches around. From the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, outgoing artistic director, I think outgoing means she's leaving the job, not that she's particularly bubbly, although she might be, Amy Mueller. She's been with the Bay Area Playwrights Festival for 19 years, and we'll talk with her as well as Candrace Jones and Tori Keenan-Zelt. And their works will be featured at the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. We'll also be talking with David Finkel, who is the founding artistic director of Music at Menlo, to talk about this year's 17th season of that series of concerts. It's going to be a musical and historical journey through 7 crucial decades in the development of Western classical music, but I'm sure there'll be reason to tap your toes and sing along, too. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Open Air. It's David LaTulipe Show, and I'm just a squatter. And we'll see you next week.